William Carlos Williams has been made to represent a great many things in the history of 20th century poetry. He is seen as a quintessentially American poet, indeed as the poet of Americanness. He is seen as the poet of the vernacular, of orality, of a break from the artificiality of traditional poetic diction and rhetoric. And following from this, he is seen as a poet of the natural, the authentic, and the sincere. Finally, he is seen as the principal objectivist. I can't go into to what extent objectivism is or is not a real school of poetry, but it is a name that's bandied about. He is seen as the principal objectivist and therefore as a poet of the object, or perhaps of objectivity. That is, the poet of a poetry which would reject the egotism of a subjective lyric position that appropriates the world for its own devices in order to withdraw before the other, giving the other space. All of these views are valid to a point, but not entirely. Also, interestingly, all of these elements are often seen as not only going together or belonging together, but each necessarily implying the other. Americanness, orality, break with tradition, authenticity, sincerity, objectivity, all of these are seen as some way forming a coherent whole. Especially the equation of Americanness with a kind of informality or unpretentiousness tied to the oral, the spoken idiom. We need to investigate this complex of ideas that constellates around William Carlos Williams. And the ideological structure that makes these ideas seem like a complex, and we'll do that to a certain extent. But first of all, Williams was also, in a rather oblique way, but a way that I hope will become less oblique, as I talk today, Williams was very much an ethical poet who believed that ethics and poetry were inseparable in certain ways. And at a time when the humanities are under threat in this country, when there's a sense of utility that the universities are meant to serve, regarding which the humanities have an uncertain status, when the humanities are, and the universities are overseen by a government department which stresses innovation, given this context, I can't refrain from quoting this passage from one of Williams's very late poems, Asphodel, That Greeny Flower. There, Williams writes, "Look at what passes for the new. You will not find it there, but in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Hear me out. For I too am concerned, and every man who wants to die at peace in his bed besides. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." Of course, these lines are an oblique reference to a famous dictum by Williams's old friend, the American poet Ezra Pound. I know that Nick Lawrence talked a bit about Pound last week in his lecture on T.S. Eliot, and indeed, it's impossible to talk about American poetry in the 20th century without talking about Pound. Instead of addressing Pound directly, he's worming his way in through the work of two of his oldest and closest friends, Eliot and Williams. Eliot, by the way, of course, was like Williams, American, though he spent most of his life in England and became a British subject. But it is hard to get the news from poems, echoes Pound, who very famously said, "Literature is news that stays news." Pound said, "Nothing is as outdated as yesterday's newspaper. Literature is news that stays news." William and Pound had been friends ever since their university days in Pennsylvania, when they were both in their late teens. And Williams's relationship to Pound was defining to many of the choices Williams made and values he adopted throughout his life. Williams quite explicitly rejected many of the things Pound represented. He certainly rejected Pound's politics as these grew progressively closer to fascism. I think Nick talked about that a little bit last week. But he also felt that certain of Pound's signal aesthetic choices were questionable. Pound, a lifelong expatriate, had for Williams abandoned the necessity of confronting and expressing the particularities of the American condition, something Williams felt had not been sufficiently addressed and which he took as his own specific task. Rather than take this at face value and say, sure, we understand Williams and Pound grow up in America, Williams wants to capture this American business and Pound retreats to Europe. And rather than take this at face value, I want us to stop and ask a different question, which would be, why is it important to express the particularities of the American condition? What are the values and assumptions underlying this kind of a position that America is there, you must confront it, you must not retreat it. If you go to Europe, in some sense, you're running away. There's a lot contained in such a value judgment. And we'll be circling that question, among others, throughout the hour. But in this connection, and again, I'm linking up with some of what you covered last week, in this connection of a specifically American poetry or a specific task for the American poet, in this connection, it was Pound's championing of another American expat poet, T.S. Eliot, which was to Williams especially regrettable. Eliot represented everything that Williams felt he was striving against in his own art. And I'm just going to read a very short passage from Williams's autobiography, which is quite interesting. And Williams, by the way, born in 83, I believe. It might have been 82, actually. I always get these. Anyway, 82 or 83. So he's about 5 years older than T.S. Eliot, about 2 years older than Ezra Pound, just to situate him historically. In Williams's autobiography, chapter 25 is called The Wasteland. And here's how it begins. "These were the years just before the great catastrophe to our letters, the appearance of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. There was heat in us, a core and a drive that was gathering headway upon the theme of a rediscovery of a primary impetus, the elementary principle of all art in the local conditions. Our work staggered to a halt for a moment under the blast of Eliot's genius, which gave the poem back to the academics. We did not know how to answer him." Should I read that again? Yeah, one more time? All right. "These were the years just before the great catastrophe to our letters, the appearance of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. There was heat in us, a core and a drive that was gathering headway upon the theme of a rediscovery of a primary impetus, the elementary principle of all art in the local conditions. Our work staggered to a halt for a moment under the blast of Eliot's genius, which gave the poem back to the academics. We did not know how to answer him." Someone mind closing that door, if possible? Someone in the back row, if you could just close it. Thank you. Pay careful attention to this denunciation of the wasteland, which, like so much else in Williams, looks simple and is not. Pay careful attention as Williams very casually delineates so many of the grounding categories of his poetic practice. "The great catastrophe to our letters. To whom does that first person plural respond? He apply. He doesn't say the great catastrophe to letters. our letters. Our, the possessive refers specifically to American writers. The Wasteland is a catastrophe to American literature. Local conditions, right? The principle of elementary principle of all art is found in the local conditions. This would combine an emphasis on Americanness, say, with the idea that the poet must write about whatever is in front of his or her face. That is, you don't do what Eliot did and go back to these strange tribal customs you got out of Fraser and who knows where he got them and if they're even accurate, and these parallels from Greek and Roman antiquity and these unreal cities of Europe. No. Instead, you look at what's in front of you. For example, a red wheelbarrow or a 15-year-old girl that the orphanage has sent to help out around your house. Finally, a very interesting phrase. Eliot, through his learned references, gave the poem back to the academics. People like me, professionally, but people like you while you're here. This would imply that poetry should be situated elsewhere, outside the academy, in another spot or another relation to the society from which it emerges. However, what this relation might be is a very difficult question indeed for Williams and really for modernism as a whole. And by this I mean, if Williams wants to find a place for the poem beyond the academy, and that's indisputable, note from the outset that Williams is certainly not a populist producing accessible verse. He doesn't want his poetry to be confined to the academy, but he's not writing the kind of mainstream conventional poetry that could be published by newspapers with wide circulations speaking to the masses, right? Those kinds of newspapers are going to look at the red wheelbarrow, and what are they going to say? They're not going to say, oh, that's simple, anyone could understand it. They're going to say, it's not poetry. So Williams is an anti-academic, but he's not a populist by any stretch of the imagination. He is no less an avant-gardist than T.S. Eliot. We need to think carefully about just what he means when he says he wants to preserve poetry from the academics. We'll return to this. We'll return to it throughout. But I think this is probably a good time for me to say that if William stayed in America and felt that this was an enormous part of his identity, as opposed to specifically Pound and Eliot, who did not, Williams himself, and I'll talk about this in more detail a little later on, had a very international background, not only in terms of his parentage, but also he was, as a high school student, educated partially in Europe. He spoke French very well. As an adult, he maintained contacts with the French avant-garde and visited Paris on several occasions at length. So don't mistake Williams for a kind of down-home, all-American guy who just hangs out in the countryside and only knows what he sees in front of him. Williams would have been, he's a little too young for it, but in terms of his background and his travels and his linguistic skills, Williams would have been perfectly at home as a character in a Henry James novel. In fact, you know, at the age of 18, Williams had seen a lot more of Europe than Pound had, for example. I can't tell the whole, I mean, the 20th century was a very good one for American poetry, extremely good. And a lot of the story of 20th century American poetry is centered in some way in this triad of Eliot, Pound, and Williams. And I cannot begin to tell the whole story here, so I won't even try. But I want to say that whatever differences there are between Pound and Williams, and there were many, they listened to each other pretty carefully for a long time. And Pound was one of the best readers Williams ever had. And I'm mentioning this to now move into some questions about Williams's poetics. And I don't know how you've all reacted to these poems you've had by Williams, his most famous poems, like, you know, his most iconic poem is The Red Wheelbarrow. And I never know if students, I mean, how many of you are reading Williams pretty much for the first time? Almost everyone. And I never know if students are going to react to The Red Wheelbarrow with delight or horror. So if I can divide you, you know, in an overly schematic way, but just for the sake of getting a sense of where you're coming from, how many put themselves on the side of delight? How many put themselves on the side of horror? Good, pretty much an even. That's what I was expecting, really, and that's what I was hoping for. So what's at stake in Williams's poetics? I'm going to try and talk about that a little bit. Again, with a caveat, Williams does a lot of different things as a poet. He doesn't have one poetics. But to start with, let's talk about the poetics as exemplified in this iconic poem, The Red Wheelbarrow. And now I want to just say that for those of you who are finding Williams a little boring, a little simple, reductive, or even more, I mean, it can be argued that Williams is a kind of fetishist of simplicity, that he fetishizes simplicity as a concept. To try and answer that, I want to call your attention to a remark from a letter that Ezra Pound sent William Carlos Williams in 1917. This is Pound to Williams, right around the time, a little before, that Williams is writing poems like The Red Wheelbarrow. Pound says, and I quote, "The thing that saves your work is opacity, and don't you forget it. Opacity is not an American quality. Fizz, swish, gabble of verbiage, these are echt Amerikanisch." I'll quote Pound again. "The thing that saves your work is opacity, and don't you forget it. Opacity is not an American quality." I want you to consider Williams as the poet of opacity. Now I shall begin to explain myself. And in so doing, first, of course, I'll make the opposite case. Yes, you might find it counterintuitive that I argue that Williams is the poet of opacity. I mean, Williams is famous for this dictum that you can find in his late poem, Patterson, a book-length poem, "No ideas but in things," or as Williams wrote it, "Say it, no ideas but in things." That's the most programmatic declaration of that kind of an idea, but you find similar things throughout Williams. I'll give you one example here, a particularly salient passage from his work, The Descent of Winter, which, like so many other works of Williams, mixes poetry and prose. Williams, by the way, an excellent prose writer. His novel, White Mule, is very good indeed. Here's an interesting passage from The Descent of Winter. "Poetry should strive for nothing else, this vividness alone, per se, for itself. The realization of this has its own internal fire, that is like nothing. Therefore, the bastardy of the simile. That thing, the vividness which is poetry by itself, makes the poem. There is no need to explain or compare. Make it, and it is a poem. This is modern, not the saga. There are no sagas, only trees now, animals, engines. There's that." But once again, I mean, if T.S. Eliot says, "You cannot simply read me, you must work, you must do this research, you must read and reread and reread and connect the lines and the dots and sort things out." If Eliot hammers you over the head with this, Williams seems to be much more straightforward, but he demands just as careful a reading to really appreciate what he's about. And let's think of these statements carefully. No ideas but in things does not mean no ideas. On the contrary. And if a thing becomes a marker, holder, container, sign of an idea, well, in that case, we do not have a poetry of simplicity or clarity, but precisely of duplicity, where thing and idea each redefine the other. Duplicity, I mean literally here, of doubleness. If there are no ideas but in things, but there are ideas, and Williams does believe that, then the thing is doubled in some way. No ideas but in things means the rejection of the simile, as stated above. Williams argues against the simile again and again. A poem doesn't need to say one thing is like something else. A poem needs to be like itself. A thing isn't meant to be like an idea, an allegory of an idea. No, that's what he's against when he says no ideas but in things. A thing isn't like an idea. And a poem isn't meant to be a representation of a thing either, but rather a poem is meant to take its place as a thing among things, facing the reader with all the obstinate alterity of a stone or a chair or a red wheelbarrow. Williams talks about this a lot in his masterpiece mixing poetry and prose called Spring and All. And actually, many of the poems I gave you on the handout are actually taken from Spring and All and are a little different in the context of Spring and All. They're less fragmentary in some ways, not in others. But it should be stressed that Williams was perfectly happy for a poem like The Red Wheelbarrow to be taken out of the context of Spring and All and just presented as a self-standing poem. But definitely, those of you who find Williams interesting, I urge you to go and get this book, Imaginations, out of the library and read Spring and All, which is one of the pieces in Imaginations. Here in Spring and All, I mean, there's a lot of relevant material in Spring and All, but one interesting point, he talks about, well, I'll just read bits of it here. Writing is not a searching about in the daily experience for apt similes and pretty thoughts and images. I have experienced that to my sorrow. It is not a conscious recording of the day's experiences freshly and with the appearance of reality. And he says that destroys nature, in fact. Interesting, bear this in mind, because I would imagine if someone asked you to talk about what Williams is doing in some of these poems, you'd be very tempted to say that he's recording the day's experiences freshly. Yet, Williams is at pains to say that's not what he wants to be doing. In fact, he says, such an approach blinds the poet to the world. Instead, these are the things Williams prizes. A world detached from the necessity of recording it, sufficient to itself, removed from him, meaning the writer, as it most certainly is, with which he has bitter and delicious relations, and from which he is independent, moving at will from one thing to another, as he pleases, unbound, complete. And the unique proof of this is the work of the imagination, not like anything, but transfused with the same forces which transfuse the earth, at least one small part of them. Nature is the hint to composition, not because it is familiar to us, and therefore the terms we apply to it have a least common denominator quality which gives them currency, not for that reason, but because nature possesses the quality of independent existence, of reality which we feel in ourselves. It is opposed to art, but opposed to it. Very important statement for Williams. The relationship between nature and art is not one of opposition only, in which art would reflect nature. It is a relationship of apposition, two things placed next to each other, in which nature and the work of art are both out there, on the same level in some way. Right? William says this in many different ways, including another passage from Spring and All. The word must be put down for itself, not as a symbol of nature, but a part, cognizant of the whole, aware, civilized. The word must be put down not as a symbol of nature, but as a part of nature. In this respect, Williams is very close to non-representational poetry, like that written by Gertrude Stein, another American expatriate, but one of whom Williams was quite fond. He believed in his piece on Gertrude Stein, he argues that Stein tries to run from the American realities, and she runs to Paris, but she cannot, and that her work is nothing if not entirely American. That all sounds very abstract, but I think it's important to have some of this abstraction not to be lost in a kind of tautological discourse of the concrete and the simple, which reduces Williams to a charming guy who loves everything and has no pretensions and is sincere in his response to them. There's more going on here. And to try and unpack what is going on and the implications of some of the things I've just talked about, let's look at his most famous poem, his iconic poem, The Red Wheelbarrow. I want you to look at the poem. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. It's an easy poem to learn by heart. But I also want you to look at it, and don't tell me that I don't have it here. I do have it. The first thing I want you to think about is the visual force of this poem. Williams, like many other poets of the early 20th century, but strikingly so, for Williams, the visual disposition of the words on the page is a major structuring element in its own right. In other words, clearly he's not writing in formal meter. But the line breaks here are not simply indications of what the voice should do reading the poem. I will talk about that. That's not the sole purpose of them. He has made something that has a look. It's a piece of visual art, not only oral art, art based on sound. The poem looks like a little box. It asserts itself as a thing, not only as a representation or transcription of a speaking voice. The wasteland is polyvocal and intertextual, and in that way spatializes the voice. It takes voices not simply as something you hear, but I mean, I know Nick played a sort of radio version of The Wasteland, but one of the things about The Wasteland and the way it uses the page is for much of the poem, you cannot be sure where one voice starts and another stops. The poem doesn't give you that. So it does something that a voice itself could not do through the resource of the page. Williams doesn't work in quite the same way, but he also spatializes the voice on the page and decenters vocal temporality as the grounding element of poetic expression. In other words, we think of a poem as something that happens over time. We hear it. Meter and rhyme emphasize the temporal movement of a poem. Williams does that too. He has a great ear. That's certainly important to Williams. It's not simply visual poetry. It's not concrete poetry in that sense. But notice also that the poem has a visual shape which imprints itself in our reception along with, next to, whatever we hear. Also notice, by the way, that this poem is extremely regular. Four two-line stanzas. The second line of each one is only one word. The first line is always three words. It's extremely regular. In the second line of each stanza, that one word always has two syllables, though you don't have a consistent stress pattern. Upon has a stress on the second syllable, but then you get barrow, water, chickens. But still, the same number of syllables. In the first and fourth stanzas, those three words give you four syllables each. In the second and third stanzas, you have three syllables each. An extremely regular poem. Also notice, getting back to what I was talking about before, line breaks do not follow breath groups or natural pauses in speech. Yet the poem uses a completely demotic spoken vernacular idiom. In other words, wheel is split from barrow, rain from water, white from chickens. If you're going to use line breaks to follow the patterns of speech, you would say so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow. You wouldn't say a red wheelbarrow. There's no break in speech between wheel and barrow. White chickens, etc. In other words, this poem, which sounds so natural, is actually quite violent in what it's doing with regular speech patterns. It creates a kind of syncopation. You get a kind of counter-rhythm, even though there's no formal verse here. And it pushes against and defamiliarizes the language that the poem is so concerned to present as plain and simple. The one sentence which makes up the poem is draped over the line breaks, I'm trying to say, in a kind of counter-syntactical manner. So you have something very strange going on here in those terms. And above all, don't let this perfectly constructed and tiny little made thing distract you from those first two lines. Think how different the poem would be without them. A red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. A nice little haiku in a way. But you've got this, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. The central premise of the poem, that so much depends upon this red wheelbarrow, the central premise is anything but clear and simple. This poem is incredibly opaque. It's a kind of a riddle. Why should anything depend on it? What kind of thing could depend on it? Why would so much depend on it? This poem's not simple in that way. It's only simple if you make it simple. I went over that in some detail just to give you a sense that in what could seem like an idle throwaway, there's actually a lot going on in a Williams poem. Technically, in terms of what he's doing with the form, what he's doing with language. It's not something that just occurs to him and he throws out there, technically, but also intellectually, metaphysically, in terms of what these poems are talking about. It's not so simple. In seminar, you might want to look at that poem, or also poems like Spring and All, title poem from the book, The Pot of Flowers, Young Sycamore and Poem. All of these poems need to be read not only as attempts at description, at presentation of the trivial particulars of the everyday. Sure, there are no sagas, only trees now, animals, engines, there's that. That is true, and abundantly so. But also focus on these poems as made things, as attempts to treat poetry and poems like sculpture. Sculpture, which is not only about the representation of other things, but about the production of objects. And that's, by the way, why I included for you the locust tree and flower in its two versions. just to see how I mean, I find those endlessly fascinating, how Williams takes this thin column of a poem, sort of shooting downward with a kind of energy. He takes this thin column of a poem, and then he cuts it down even further. And in the second version of The Locust Tree and Flower, it's not really syntactical. You can't really tell what it's talking about, but it's like this kind of amazing column of words that he produces there. So yes, Williams is a great poet of opacity, of the fact that in truth, we cannot see through the objects we look at. A poet of the fact that the world around us, in fact, does not speak back, but resists us in its difference, in its refusal to be assimilated. It resists the meanings that we give it, yet meaning seems to pour out of it. The sense of a fundamental complexity to his poetry and not simplicity is one Williams himself embraces towards the end of his life. Again, in the poem Asphodel, Williams writes, "The poem is complex and the place made in our lives for the poem." This is not just sentimentality. Williams is consonant here with a wide swathe of modernism by insisting that his poems make demands. They do not occupy their space quietly and comfortably, but they ask you in your life to find a place for them and to allow that place the complexity it needs. The poem is complex, and the place made in our lives for the poem must be complex. This is the complexity we fight for and defend every time we do serious work as readers. But it's something that comes at a cost of time, energy, and frankly, the investment of an entire educational system. And it's therefore something that not everyone can afford, and Williams was very aware of this. Now, in the passage from the autobiography that I cited, Williams certainly seems to dismiss Eliot as an elitist. No question. But at the same time, as I've been trying to point out, Williams, too, was an elitist. He was not writing poetry for popular newspapers. Williams' readership came from a very small avant-garde. Williams was only appreciated by the most advanced and minuscule artistic circles. Williams was less appreciated than Eliot, in fact. So Williams is not a populist in that way. He would make no compromises with popular mainstream taste and convention. So in what way is he less of an elitist than Eliot? Well, Williams was also a man of the people in his way. Williams was a country doctor, a general practitioner in rural New Jersey. That's how he earned a living, not through writing poetry. And most of the people he served were, or at least very many of them, were very poor rural folk, paying him in things they were growing on their land, if they could pay him at all. This is the people Williams spent his day with, these people living simple and hard lives, not the rarefied salons of the wealthy artistic set that was the exclusive social space of Eliot and Pound. Williams knew them too, but his day job was working there in rural New Jersey with this population. I think Williams, he estimates that he delivered 20,000 babies. I can't remember. And this was extremely important to Williams' sense of himself as a writer and a person. The poem that reflects these concerns, perhaps most famously, another of Williams' most iconic poems, is To Elsie. But interestingly, that poem To Elsie, a poem that Eliot or Pound never could have written, interesting that this poem also for Williams is specifically about his own Americanness and his mission as an American poet. And here again, Williams is very tricky. He wrote a whole book about American culture and artistic culture called In the American Grain. But who emerges as the prime American writer for Williams? You'd think it could be Whitman, the first writer who uses the American spoken language as a resource for poetry. Whitman would be logical. You'd think it could be Hawthorne, the first novelist to really go into specifically colonial American themes and make them the subjects of his stories. No, neither Whitman nor Hawthorne. Who is the most really American writer for Williams? Of all people, Edgar Allan Poe, the one who lived in Europe, the one whose writing in its language sounds much more English than that of most of his American contemporaries. Well, maybe not most, but he makes no effort to register the American sound of the language, as Williams does. Poe, the one who many of his works are set in Europe, doesn't really care about depicting American scenes. Nevertheless, for Williams, the American writer who most responds to the local conditions, the local is a very important word for Williams, the one who most responds to the local conditions of America, who most authentically responds to those conditions, is Edgar Allan Poe. Given those criteria, according to Williams' own logic, you could argue that T.S. Eliot is more American than William Carlos Williams, because for Williams, a relationship to the American language, a relationship to depictions of American life are not what make you ultimately an American writer. So once again, Williams is much more tricky than he might seem. And very interestingly, in that same letter from Pound to Williams, where Pound says it's opacity which saves your work, not clarity, Pound also says, don't give me any of this nonsense about being an American poet and the need to be an American poet. You don't know anything about America because you're not even American, basically, Pound says. Why does Pound say this? On the one hand, he says that Williams had never gone west of New England, but Pound never really had. Pound spent the very early years of his childhood in Idaho, but Pound didn't know anything about that either. But the main reason he says this is because Pound, who could trace his family back as Americans for several generations on both sides and pretty much to the 17th century on one, and Eliot certainly could, was descended from some of the prominent families who first came over in the 17th century. Well, Williams's father was English, and his mother was Puerto Rican, hence the Carlos. So Pound viewed Williams' insistence on his American identity as a kind of overcompensation, as a reflection of Williams' anxiety at not being really American enough at all. Pound thought Williams was less American than himself, basically. But of course, for Williams, that was the very point Pound missed, the idea that Americanness is the immigrant experience, and that American identity is the culture of feeling alienated from or illegitimate within one's own culture. For Williams, there's nothing more American than not being fully American. I'm going too far. That's a side of Williams. Certainly for more and more writers, that will be articulated throughout the 20th century. Williams begins to pose that question with acuity. By the way, Williams did not have a typical immigrant experience, and that the vast majority of immigrants to America of Williams's time came from very, very impoverished parts of mostly Europe, but also Asia. And Williams didn't. His parents were privileged didn't come to America for the typical reasons or in the typical conditions. Just a few minutes left to talk about To Elsie, with its incredibly famous first line. And look at what Williams does with those line breaks. The pure products of America go crazy. mountain folk from Kentucky or the rib north end of Jersey with its isolate lakes and valleys, its deaf mutes, thieves, old names, and promiscuity between devil-may-care men who have taken to railroading out of sheer lust of adventure, and young slatterns bathed in filth from Monday to Saturday to be tricked out that night with gauds from imaginations which have no peasant traditions to give them character, but flutter and flaunt sheer rags, succumbing without emotion save numbed terror under some hedge of chokecherry or viburnum, which they cannot express. Unless it be that marriage, perhaps, with a dash of Indian blood, will throw up a girl so desolate, so hemmed round with disease or murder, that she'll be rescued by an agent, reared by the state, and sent out at 15 to work in some hard-pressed house in the suburbs. Some doctor's family, some Elsie, voluptuous water expressing with broken brain the truth about us. Her great ungainly hips and flopping breasts addressed to cheap jewelry and rich young men with fine eyes. As if the earth under our feet were an excrement of some sky, and we degraded prisoners destined to hunger until we eat filth, while the imagination strains after deer going by fields of goldenrod in the stifling heat of September, somehow it seems to destroy us. It is only an isolate flex that something is given off. No one to witness and adjust, no one to drive the car. I know you had a lecture on the Wasteland last week, and I'm actually teaching the Wasteland last week. I was in a different module. And the uncanny thing to me, though this is completely, well, a little crazy to say, but it's uncanny how similar this poem is in many ways to the Wasteland, though you probably shouldn't write that on your exam. But you have many of the same themes. Look at this question of precisely a degraded contemporary culture of consumption that Americans stripped from the old traditions of Europe. So the folk practices, the practices of the poor, are not underpinned by peasant traditions. They have none of that dignity. They're totally dominated by the vulgarity of the marketplace. Very interesting claim for Williams to be making there. That's something that's specifically American. Look at this depiction of degraded and debased sexual relations, you know, a major theme of the Wasteland. But we're running out of time. There are two really important things that you need to think about as you talk about this poem in your seminars, if you do. First, the pure products of America. Go crazy. Purity. Is this simply irony to say the pure products of America? Because the products of America aren't pure. Elsie is the product of a mixed marriage. Or is William seriously trying to think through what is purely American? If we're going to define America in its purity, what is in fact purely American? Is it in fact Elsie? Is she in fact really the most American thing? Is she the essence of America? Is a sort of ethnic mixing what is most purely American? What is a pure product of America? That's one thing I want you to think about. Notice, of course, how he brings the poem back from a general situation, the pure products of America go crazy, to his own situation, some house in the suburb, some doctor's house maybe, you know, his house. Elsie, all of a sudden, isn't just something he's thought of. It's someone he's seen. But finally, I want you to think of the very enigmatic ending of this poem. No one to witness and adjust. Presumably, the person who witnesses and adjusts is the poet. Presumably. That's how it's usually read. That's the poet's job, is to witness this, to not let it go unrecorded. But then, no one to drive the car. Now, many readers of Williams read this as a kind of lament for anarchy. Again, this would make it sound a lot like Eliot. There's a car, an automobile. No one's driving it. We need a driver. We need a sense of direction. We need a leader. Given William, and you'll find a lot of readings that will stress that, given Williams's misgivings about simile, metaphor, allegory in general, I tend not to read it that way. I tend to read these things in apposition. No one to witness and adjust, that laments the lack of a poet. No one to drive the car is putting that lack of a poet on the same plane as the kind of casual, everyday catastrophe that besets anyone in a overburdened and underprivileged environment trying to get through the necessities of the daily survival. Remember this poem from, say, 1923. Driving a car was not as generalized a skill as it is now. It's much more easy to imagine a car and no one to drive it. So we are out of time. I hope that got you started on William Carlos Williams. And you'll see me in a few weeks for James Joyce and A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.